You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is brought to you by Edwards Ham. Their delectable Suriano hams are all natural, made only from purebred six-spotted Berkshire hogs. This rare breed is 100% pasture-raised to produce a perfectly marbled meat with just the right amount of internal fat to produce a rich, distinctive flavor. Edwards' product has been featured at restaurants such as Momofuku Sambar, Union Square Cafe, Bubby's Pie, and Murray's Cheese. For more information on Edwards ham, visit surreyfarms.com. Welcome to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And I find that fruit can be so disappointing. Fruit can be one of life's great disappointments. You see a peach or a melon in the store and it looks pretty good and it smells nice and you think that you possess some sort of inherent ability to pick out winning fruit specimens, some kind of secret power over other people, like I know how to pick out a good melon. So you take a gamble, you roll those fruity dice, and you take it home. And you leave it out on the counter for a couple of days to let it get riper or at least softer. And then it's time and you crack it open. And I would say, if I had to put a number value on it, 6 out of 10 times, major disappointment. Mealy, mushy, no flavor, no juice, no sweet acid balance. I think that fruit should come with a guarantee. What other food do we buy has such a huge risk attached to it? If I went to the store and I bought a package of, let's say, chicken, and when I got it home and I opened it, it turned out to be bad, I would take it back in a second, right? And demand my purchase price back. Or if I bought a loaf of bread and it was moldy, right back to the store. I'd march right back down to that A&P and I would demand it because it's my right as a consumer. But why do we allow sub-quality fruit in our lives? Who takes fruit back? Kramer did, for one, on an episode of Seinfeld. He returns his sub-quality fruit, and I've often been inspired to do that. And I appreciate that, and I think we should start doing it more often. We should all start returning our sub-quality fruit back to the market where it came from. Because if we all returned our bad fruit all the time, we would start a revolution. And stores would have to start stocking better and better fruit until the balance tipped, and it was like we were living in Seattle or Santa Monica, which are the two places where I've eaten transcendent fruit in the U.S. So think about it. We could start a revolution, people. Don't accept the bad fruit. Take it back from whence it came. So this past weekend, I had to get some fruit. And I had to go to the local supermarket instead of the local farmer's market because we were upstate at our little cottage and I had a house full of family. The whole family was visiting and we decided to spend the day up at the Dia Art Center in Beacon. You ever hear of it? So by the time we got back to the cottage, it was too late for the farmer's market, which ends at 2, and we were all worn out from trying to understand all the conceptual art that transcended time and space, according to our guide, who was a very funny guy who kept saying, right, right, you get it, you get it, when talking about the art. If you go to the Dia Art Center, take a tour, because it helps you understand how the artwork transcends time and space and all media. So anyway, at our local A&P that I go to when I'm desperate, they had some nectarines from California. And normally, I would avoid those at all costs because they're shipped in thousands of miles. But these were some extremely fragrant nectarines. It was like someone had sprayed them with nectarine perfume. They almost smelled that strangely nectariney, almost synthetic. And they were like perfectly yielding to the touch, which is how fruit like that should feel, like an avocado when it's ripe, you press it. So I got a few. I decided I would take a few. And then to kind of make up for my massive carbon footprint that I had just left on the ground, I thought I would offset it, you know, with a few carbon credits. And so they also had some so-called local peaches that looked pretty good. They were from New Jersey. I was in Westchester, close enough. They looked pretty good. They didn't have much of a smell, which was suspicious. But they looked good. They were slightly yielding. I thought, they're local, so they must be okay. Like some, you know, some Kool-Aid drinking Stepford wife of Michael Pollan. In my head, I kept saying, local is better. They must be better. I'm brainwashed. They must be better. So we brought those home, those peaches. I brought them home. And as soon as I got home, my 10-year-old niece grabbed one right away because she wanted one. And she bit into it. And, well, local fruit can really suck ass, too. Wouldn't you know it, those local New Jersey peaches, this is nothing against New Jersey or its peaches because they can be amazing, those peaches totally, totally sucked. They were mealy, they were mushy, they had no flavor. And at the same time, those California nectarines were unbelievably good. It totally upset my whole philosophy and rocked my whole world and left me with four more really bad New Jersey peaches and no nectarines left because everybody immediately grabbed them and ate them, which kind of pissed me off because I had paid for them and I wanted some. I got one. So I decided I would leave those remaining peaches sitting on the windowsill and give them a day or two to kind of redeem themselves. Maybe they just needed a little rest and a little ripening time after their long journey from New Jersey. Maybe they just needed to kind of come into their own as peaches. But no, this morning, not this morning, yesterday morning, Sunday morning, still sucky peaches. I didn't take them back to the store. I didn't really have the time or the inclination. So what did I do? I threw them in the woods behind my house, which is what I do with things like corn cobs and watermelon rinds and various vegetable detritus. Instead of making a compost heap, I just chuck it all in the woods behind the house. But I threw the peaches back there whole, which means the pits landed, which means that someday my descendants will have a tree that produces terrible peaches to remind them of me and to remind them of the era before the money-back guarantee that fruit was given that would give you and grant you your absolute right, protected in the future by the Constitution to good fruit. But I don't really want to talk about peaches anymore today because my last show was kind of all about peaches and other yellow foods. I just want to talk about fruit and ripeness and the bursting juicy glory that we are having right now in these last few weeks of August. I feel like the last half of August, the summer kind of throws itself into this frenzy because it knows it's about to die. And it gets itself all crazed and ripe and bursting and fecund. And then in a few weeks, dead. So that's what I want to talk about. And incidentally, because of my last show about peaches, I've been asked to be a guest on NPR on All Things Considered on WNYC on August 26th. I'll let you know exact time when I know better. But they're doing a series called Last Chance Foods. And it's not about last chance foods as in like tuna, which is about to become extinct, but foods that are only in season and perfect for a few weeks. So you better hurry up and stuff your face full of them now because they'll be gone soon for another 10 or 11 months and you'll have to wait. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today is that you got to grab that fruit while you see it and eat it while it's ripe. And that's a theme that continues throughout all the shows that I do. I did that with asparagus early in the summer. I do that with tomatoes. I think I talked about peas early on. You have to kind of wallow in it while it's really available and then just let it fade away and say goodbye. But the two of the many fruits that I always find perpetually disappointing and frustrating are the apricot and the fig. As hard as it is to find a good peach, it's even harder and more elusive to find a good apricot. So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about my eternal quest for apricot nirvana. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is brought to you by Edwards Ham. For more information on Edwards Ham, visit surreyfarms.com. And that's S-U-R-R-Y farms.com. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, along with being many other things, too, in the food world. So we're talking about fruit today and about the frustration and disappointment that goes along with being a habitual fruit eater. I love fruit, but I'm constantly disappointed by sucky fruit. And one of the most often sucky fruits is the apricot. Now, I just took a survey here in the studio of whether we say apricot or apricot. And Jack says apricot, but Nat says apricot. And I go back and forth. I find myself using both. I don't know which one's more correct. It's like endive and endive. At least that, it's like, are you French or are you English? But I don't know which one it is with apricot. See, I said app there, not ape. So, whatever. Anyway, if I had to assign a number value, a percentage value, that's come up a couple times today, assigning a percentage value. If I had to assign a percentage value of delicious apricots I've ever eaten versus all the apricots I've ever eaten in my quest for deliciousness, it would be a very low number indeed. Probably a number in the low teens. That would be teens out of 100. 100 being every apricot was perfect. Teens. Apricot after apricot. I've smelled, felt, pressed, pulled apart, and bitten into, only to be insulted by the dryness, mealiness, flavorlessness, utter disappointment, one after another. But like a faithful pet, like a faithful dog, I keep coming back, hoping that the next apricot will be like the ones that I ate in Italy or at that Santa Monica Farmers Market one September a few years ago. I feel like the Santa Monica Farmers Market is fruit nirvana. I had the best fruit I've ever eaten there, and also in Seattle. I ate the best nectarine ever in Seattle. Now, I know they're really delicate, and they're really hard to pack and ship. And so if they're too ripe when they're picked, they'll squish. They're too soft. But I also know that they're grown locally, but the local ones just, I don't know. It's really, really hard. It's this holy grail of fruit. But the smell and the taste of a perfect apricot is, it's like nectar of the gods. I can't even explain it. I can't go on because it's too painful to relive the memories of the perfect apricot compared to what I experience. But I keep buying them. Every year I go to Union Square. Every year when they're in season, I go searching. I see the piles of them. They're so beautiful with their yellowy blush skin. They look like a gigantic pile of little teeny tiny baby tushes to me, like little pink fuzzy tushies, which sounds kind of strange and disgusting, but think about how cute a baby's little butt is. So I see these piles, I smell them, I taste when they offer freebies. They'll always give you a taste, they'll give you a freebie. And that right there, too, is another cruel irony of the endless search for good fruit, because they give you a taste. It's like a drug dealer. I'll give you a little taste. And maybe you'll pick a really good one, and you'll get all excited, and you'll think, oh, I've hit apricot jackpot time. And so you'll buy a pound or two. You know, not cheap either. It's some money. And who knows what kind of percentage of good versus evil will coexist in that bag of innocent-looking fruit that you just bought. You never know. It's a gamble. Why can't they be like those ridiculously good donut peaches that I got 2 weeks ago at the Borough Hall Market in Brooklyn? Those were so good. They didn't even taste like peaches. They tasted like peach candy. They were offering freebies. And so just to be sure, I surreptitiously took 3 or 4. I know a freebie means try one, but I wanted to make sure that I was going to get my money's worth in my investment, so I figured 3 would give me a good market sample. It's like when I cook beans. When you cook beans, you're always supposed to taste 3 beans, at least, for doneness. Take like a random sampling of beans, so to speak, because they cook unevenly, so you have to You have to taste at least three beans. So I took three of those donut peaches at Borough Hall, and they were all superior quality peaches. I could say exceptional. They were little tiny. You know those donut peaches? They look like they got stepped on. They're really small. So I bought some of those, and that was a truly transformative peach experience. And so every year with the apricots, I'm hoping for that. So maybe this year. I'm not sure if they're even still around. I saw them a few weeks ago at Union Square. I'll have to pop over there this week and check it out. But if you know of any exceptional apricots, if you've encountered them, send me a message. Either leave a message on the Heritage Radio Network page for Why We Cook, or you can find the show on Facebook, Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network, or you can go to whywecook.com. You have many options for getting in touch with me to share your source for good apricots. And believe me, I'm willing to travel, and I will pay whatever it takes to get a good apricot. All right, so now I want to leave the apricot behind, and now I want to talk a little bit about the fig, the iconic, symbolic fig of biblical and historical lore. The ancient fruit of the Greeks and Romans and of mythology and of the Bible and of the Fertile Crescent and the Mediterranean. The first clothing source for humans, the fig leaf. Clothed the first couple, the original first couple, not the Obamas. They were J. Crew, but the original first couple, Adam and Eve, they wore fig leaves. The fig actually is thought to be the first crop that humans ever cultivated. Thousands of years before they cultivated wheat and rye, which were the first crops or the second first crops, figs were the first. They are basically the foundation of agriculture. Figs are agriculture. They think that in the Fertile Crescent, ancient world, that's where agriculture began, and it was figs that people were growing. So if we've been growing figs, cultivating figs for that long, that it was the first thing we ever grew, why are 90% of them so bad? Why haven't we gotten it down yet? Well, yet again, it comes down to location. Just like real estate and apricots, if they're not grown basically right outside your door, they're likely going to suck. They're going to be in the sucky fruit category. And most of them really do. Now, I have definitely had some decent figs. You can get figs that I would say, if I had to grade them, A to F. I have had maybe a B fig. I'm not going to go beyond like B. No B plus. But B. A solid B. Like a good student who's going to get into like maybe a good state school or second tier private school. You know, a solid B. We're not talking Ivy League figs here. You know, they have a nice pink interior and a passable figgy flavor. And remember, we're talking about fresh figs here, not dried figs. And I was previously talking about fresh apricots, not dried apricots, because both in their dried forms are incredibly reliable and always good, because when they're dry, they pick them as ripe as possible, throw them out in the sun, dry them out, and that's it. But we're talking fresh. So a couple days I had a fig experience that actually totally rocked my world. It was a transformative fig experience. It seriously shattered some of my illusions about figs. So I'm going to leave you hanging with that. We're going to take another little break. And when we come back, the fig. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is brought to you by Edwards Ham. For more information on Edwards Ham, visit surreyfarms.com. So speaking of ham, what goes better with ham than fresh figs? So I'm talking today about disappointing fruit experiences, the quest for the perfect apricot, the quest for a delicious fresh fig. And at the end of the last segment, I was saying that I finally had a transformative fig experience a few days ago. So I was working an event at ICE. And, you know, it was like a party, special event with another chef. And one of our old students came in. Our old students come back to work on events with us sometimes. And she had with her a little box of figs. And they were really small figs. They were about half the normal size and much darker skinned. And she brought them in. And she said, "These are from the tree in my garden in Queens." And you could tell right away that we were not in ordinary fig territory. We were not in grade B fig land because you could smell them right out of the box. And I took one of those little figs and I broke it open, and the interior was like the deepest, darkest crimson color. Really, really dark red, like blood. Not like the pallid kind of frosty pink that you usually see in a fig. And the flavor was like really, really deep and complex. It was almost winey. That's W-I-N-Y, winey. Like a deep, like Sangiovese kind of winey. It was really amazing. And it, so by far, it was definitely one of the best figs I've ever had, and probably one of the best pieces of fruit I've ever eaten. And she said that they had bought their house in Queens from an old Italian man, and he had cultivated this tree for decades. And that makes sense, because I live near Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn, and that used to be a very Italian neighborhood. Not so much anymore, but you can see the fig trees in the gardens around there, and there used to be a lot of old Italian guys there who used to cultivate a lot of fig trees, and the fig trees are still around. And I've always had fig tree envy of those old guys, not to mention backyard envy, or also not to mention house envy in Carroll Gardens, because those are some great houses. But I've always thought, oh, it'd be great if I had a little garden in Brooklyn. I could grow myself a fig tree. They're not so resistant to cold weather, so I don't know if I could put one in upstate at the little bungalow. It might survive. You have to wrap them up in the winter, like in burlap, and keep them warm. You have to put like a fig blanket on the tree. But anyway, so figs are a strange fruit because they can be like a little tannic if they're not ripe enough, and there's this kind of weird like white latexy kind of white sap that runs out of the skin. They're kind of milky. That can be a little off-putting sometimes, especially if they're not ripe, because that'll be kind of also kind of like astringent. I mean, I would definitely call figs a challenging fruit. They're not going to be sold in bulk at Walmart or something. Maybe they sell them, But, you know, figs are for people who seek out more challenging fruit experiences. And I would guess that for a lot of people, their only relationship with the fig is from the world of the Fig Newton. Eating the dried fig in the cookie, which is a good place to be in that relationship, but not if you're like a real true fig lover. Speaking of Walmart, take a little guess as to what the number one most widely sold item at Walmart is worldwide. What does Walmart sell the most of anything else in the world? Just take a little guess. Think about it for a minute. Give up? Bananas. Walmart sells more individual bananas on a per unit basis than anything else they sell in the entire world. It's kind of interesting since we're talking about fruit. But anyway, one of the things I really love about the figs, though, is that I can use them as a way to torment vegetarians and vegans, which is an activity that I particularly enjoy. It's kind of a hobby. Because if you think about a fig, they're actually not purely vegetarian fruit. Did you know that about them? They're kind of carnivorous. And two of the most commonly grown varieties, the ones that you're going to eat if you buy them commercially, are the Smyrna fig and the Mission fig. Now, the Smyrna figs are the carnivores and the Mission aren't. So if it's really an issue to you, you want to make sure that you get the Mission figs, because the Smyrna figs have something creepy going on. So figs aren't really a true fruit. A true fruit is what happens when something flowers, and then the flower falls off and it develops into a fruit, like a peach Peach blossom, peach. Cherry blossom, cherry. But figs are what's called an inflorescence, which is a group of tiny flowers, a cluster of tiny flowers that grow together in an enclosed clump, sort of inverted. And it technically, it looks like a fruit, but technically it's not. And so in order to be pollinated, the Smyrna figs need the fig wasp, which is a specialized wasp that lives symbiotically with the fig. They need each other to survive. And so the female fig wasp enters the inflorescence, the fig flower, to lay her eggs in there. But she works so hard to get in there that she can't get out and she dies. And then the fig digests her. And so when you eat that fig, there are tiny bits of digested fig wasp in every bite. And if that freaks you out, think about how that must freak out vegans and vegetarians. Because they're not realizing that they're eating little fig corpses every time they bite into that fruit. So they should just stick with the mission figs, not the Smyrna. They're not wasp pollinated. They're pollinated in other ways, and therefore they're vegetarian. So here's actually a really good technical description of what happens. This is from Wikipedia. Through the li- oh, nope, not through. Though the lives of individual species differ, a general fig wasp life cycle is as follows. In the beginning of the cycle, a mature female pollinator wasp enters a receptacle, known as the fruit, through a small natural opening, the ostiole, passes through the mouth of the fig, which is covered in male flowers, and deposits her eggs in the cavity, which is covered in female flowers, by oviposition. Okay, so she's entering and she's depositing her eggs. Forcing her way through the ostiole, she often loses her wings and most of her antenna. To facilitate her passage through the ostiole, the underside of the female's head is covered with short spines that provide purchase on the walls of the ostiole. In depositing her eggs, the female also deposits pollen she picked up from her original host fig. This pollinates some of the female flowers on the inside surface of the fig and allows them to mature. After the female wasp lays her egg and follows through with pollination, she dies, allowing the fig to consume her corpse. After pollination, there are several species of non-pollinating wasps which deposit their eggs before the figs harden. These wasps act as parasites to either the fig or the pollinating wasps. You still with me here? As the fig develops, the wasp eggs hatch and develop into larvae. After going through the pupal stage, the mature male's first act is to mate with a female. The males of many species lack wings and are unable to survive outside the fig for a sustained period of time. After mating, a male wasp begins to dig out of the fig, creating a tunnel for the females to escape through. Okay, you got that? Once out of the fig, the male wasps quickly die. The females find their way out, picking up pollen as they do. Then they fly to another tree of the same species where they deposit their eggs and allow the cycle to begin again. All of that just to bring you Smyrna figs. So think about that. The pollination cycle of the fig. It's kind of disgusting when you think about it, but also really fascinating and very good for dropping into conversations at dinner parties. And if that doesn't sufficiently impress your friends, here's a little more about the beautiful fig that you should store away in your useful tidbit files. So you know, you may or not know, figs have often been seen as a metaphor for femininity due to the appearance of their interiors. If you catch my drift, you break them open, they're kind of red and fleshy. So in ancient Greece, there was a hand gesture called psychophantis, which meant showing the fig. It was considered quite the vulgar act, showing the fig, either actually showing the fig, if you know what I mean, or making the hand gesture. So the word sycophant comes from the Greek word for one who shows the fig, implying vulgarity, but also femininity and weakness. So if somebody is a sycophant or sycophant, not only are they showing the fig, but they're also exposing themselves as a weakling or as feminine if you associate femininity with weakness. So to my modern ears, it's a little bit offensive, but I love figs so much that I'm willing to see beyond that. And if somebody wanted to show me the fig, and it was a really good fig, like the one that I ate last week, I'd put all offense aside and ask them where I could buy some. So we're out of time. Thanks for listening to Why We Cook. Remember, you can find us on Facebook. You can leave us messages. You have all kinds of ways. You can also, of course, podcast on iTunes. And we will see you next week.